For 2 weeks, we've talked about civil disobedience because of some of the things that's taking place in the book of Acts. We got through Acts chapter 18, verse 1, and sort of some information in verse 2. That's where we want to go back and begin today. I'm going to read both of those verses so we can get the full text before us and then hopefully make some additional points and continue to sort down through that 18th chapter. 18:1 says, after these things, that's Paul, he departed from Athens and came to Corinth. Got some things to say about Corinth. And he found a certain Jew named Aquila, a man of Pontus by race, Italy, lately come from Italy, with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had commanded all the Jews to depart from Rome, and he came unto them. Luke said that, as you look at the information that's here, what brought Priscilla and Aquila to Corinth? All right, they were kicked out. It was political, wasn't it? It's interesting to me that sometimes people, when political matters come up, they see a great distinction between politics and the Bible. If you ever think about it, though, do you find a connection between politics and the Bible? Are the two connected in any way? I mean, here's one example, right? You've got political information, and it's discussed within the inspired text. Carolyn will take Stan's hand.
Well, and then even at the time when Mary had, was carrying Jesus,
yes,
she was commanded to go to Bethlehem, so that was a political thing, too.
Yeah. You think about Jesus' birth? Politics. What about his death? Politics. What about in between his birth and his death?
Politics.
Politics. Some of it secular and some of it religious. And you really cannot separate the life of Jesus from politics. Stan?
In general, maybe an overall issue is found in John's Revelation, where he talked about the corrupt church and corrupt government.
Yes.
Civil government.
Yeah. One of the two beasts is evil civil government, and it's just sprinkled throughout. Well, I mean, it's probably poured. Maybe more bad is better than sprinkled. But there's a lot of information in the Book of Revelation. What about the Old Testament politics? Steve, I'll take your hand and then I'll go back to the question.
Well, what's going on there is the Jews are being told to leave Rome, and Aquila and Priscilla are Jews. So.
That's exactly right. What about the Old Testament? Do you see politics there? Don, I just had to get on the right side of Tim's head.
Were they Christians then?
We're going to talk about that. We don't know, but we'll talk about that. Yes.
Whenever they were, the people said we want them, and what they did, you know, bad kings, good kings.
Yeah. North, South, Israel, Judah. I mean, First and Second Kings, and you've got a bunch of stuff in Chronicles as well. At least four Old Testament books. It's kind of interesting then, and I do understand why people say, well, you know, don't really mix religion with politics and how that relates to our time and so forth. But I do also think that as you talk about that or think about that, you also have to realize that there is a lot of information in the Bible where there is a connection between political people, political events, and God's people. That still has some spillover today. So we are thankful that we don't have a state-run religion. Things like that are certainly not helpful to God's people. But at the same time, we do live in a world where a lot of political stuff happens, and there are some strong connections. Here, we read about a ruler. His name was Claudius. He was a Roman emperor. He was someone who reigned from AD 41 to 54. And like some other people, I mean, if you become president or you are a ruler of another country, probably what's going to be on your mind? You're not going to reign forever, right? Some people die in office, but most people, they hang it up at some point. And what do you want? You want a
legacy.
You want a legacy. So what do you do? How do you create a legacy?
You build a lot of
things. There you go. That's exactly right. That new highway, you spent some time in Tennessee. Who's got his name on a highway down there? That was the one that I was thinking of, Al Gore. I've driven on that highway several times, and it's a highway that's dedicated to him. And you see that. You know, I was the one who was responsible for the funding. I was the one who was responsible for getting this land. And if it's not a highway, it may be a building. It might be a water project. There's a dam that's created. or in ancient times it was an aqueduct, those kinds of things. And he was somebody that did a lot of building, constructed new roads, aqueducts, canals. He was also someone, and we would probably think this odd, but what if President Trump were to say, I'm going to preside over some trials? I think people, whatever their political affiliation, would say, hey, that's just not right. But this guy actually presided over some trials. So he's out there, let's build the new roads, and we're over here. I want to lay in on some trials. He made some moral judgments. He gave some medical advice. One of the most famous was he promoted yew juice for snake bites. Now, I don't think that worked out very well, but this is kind of a fella. He's got his tentacles. He's got his hands on a lot of different things. Unfortunately, he was a man who was also, as far as character, he was a weak man, known to be someone who's not the strongest person morally, manipulated by a lot of people, including his wives. He was married multiple times. Dignitaries sometimes also were able to influence him in bad ways. And he's the guy who, somewhere around AD 49, AD 50, about 20 years, maybe a little less than 20 years after the church has been established, he orders the Jews out of Rome. Now, Luke, does he say why Claudius ordered the Jews out of Rome? Does he tell us? He doesn't. There is, though, a little piece of history, non-inspired, where it says the Jews were involved in a conflict over Christus. C-H-R-E-S-T-U-S. Now, assuming that little bit of history is true, what does Christus sound like? It sounds a lot like Christ. So people have tried to sort of piece that together and say there was this conflict over Christus, maybe a corrupted form of Christ. And we know that the Jews were not always that enthused about having Christians around. And this conflict may have been enough to stir things up. We've talked about this before. We've seen this in society. As long as things are peaceful, are rulers pretty much content to let things go? You think the mayor wants to get a phone call and say, we've got trouble over here in 3rd Street? What's the mayor want when he goes to work? What kind of day?
Huh? A good day.
Well, and a peaceful day, yes. Phone, if it doesn't ring, that's the hotline over there. I don't want to see the red phone go off. And the president is like that as well. It's just like the boss of a company. You know, he doesn't want problem after problem after problem. He wants those good days. He wants those peaceful days. He wants those easy days. So Rome, their rulers were surely people who had that same kind of mindset. And if you're a Jew, you're stirring things up, you are possibly disturbing society, you're probably going to get the attention of some form of law enforcement. And that was true for the Romans as well. They like peace. And this controversy about Christ, they might have just said, enough, and we're going to get the Jews and this religious controversy out of our hair because we just don't want the hassle. Now, here's an interesting thing. When people were kicked out, it's obviously possible to kick somebody out in a couple of different ways, isn't it? Let's say it's a wife. She's kicking her husband out of the apartment. How might that happen?
She changed her locks.
Well, okay, it could be that. I've changed the locks and you're not going to get back in. Now, that's relevant as far as Rome because apparently there were some rules where if they kicked you out and you decided that you were going to work your way back in, that was considered treason or sedition. It wasn't a matter of kind of like we see sometimes today, some people sneak across the border and then they get caught again and it's, well, you know, you shouldn't have done that, but there's not going to be any consequence. If you're caught and you are charged with treason or sedition, if it's that serious, there's probably going to be a big, big penalty.
As you mentioned, Mexicans coming across the border.
Correct.
Get involved in things and then they're kicked out. They don't have a green card or anything, then it's shipped back in.
Right. There is that cycle. But for Rome, if they kicked you out, it didn't cycle like that. All right, the wife is upset with the husband and she decides to kick him out. How else could that go?
They could gather people up and take them out.
That's true too. They could force you out. And perhaps that happened with some of the Jews. They didn't want to leave. Anything else? The wife says to the husband, you're done here. Yeah, or what about in the dumpster? Just before the garbage man shows up. Now, she didn't perhaps confiscate the property, but she did dispose of it. And from what I've read, as far as with Rome, if they kicked you out, they could keep your property. Now, that was a pretty serious thing. You imagine that you've worked for land, you've created this farm or you've created this business, you've got a nice shop and you've got tools and customers, and they come in and say, "Are you a Jew?" "Oh yeah." "You're done. Give me the keys and leave." Just with the clothes on your back. Well, you can imagine that people would be tempted to sneak back, wouldn't they? I mean, I think that would be a temptation for me, especially if my livelihood is there. I want to get my tools. If I have to move, at least give me my tools so I can go somewhere else and set up shop. Sneak back in. Treason, sedition. So this was, for these people, this was serious, serious stuff. So Ray after Gary, but Gary comes first. Oh, I'm sorry, you're second. Oh, Don, it was you. Sorry.
Well, parallels with Rome and us today, really there's no parallel because...
Correct.
Claudius was an emperor. He was one person, supreme for everything. So whatever he said went.
Yeah.
Today, of course, we have some countries in this world today that are close to what Claudius was. That their word was everything.
Yeah.
There was no...
Correct, and we're going to see that again a little later in the chapter. Our president can do quite a bit. There are certainly executive orders, but he can't do everything. He can't say, "All right, we're going to, you know, spend X number of dollars without congressional support," and then you got the Senate, and then some things can be kicked over. We've got three supposedly co-equal branches of government, which every system of government has its strengths and weaknesses. For us, some things can hit a log jam and it's impossible or very difficult to get them passed. But at the same time, our system of government should work really well when it comes to certain checks and balances. And in this particular case, these people, as you said, had a much different system.
Yeah. We have one thing that the other world doesn't have, that's, you know, we have the Constitution.
Correct.
So to go up against the Constitution would be very, very difficult for any politician.
Yeah, it would. And in this particular case, it was, well, I mean, he, the Constitution is with him, so to speak. I mean, there were obviously some rules of Rome, but he is the fellow who lays down the law, and that's how it's going to be.
You see, in the Old Testament, when God drove the Israelites and Judah out of Israel, that 70 years later,
right,
he brought them back in. It's a little bit different.
You go back. Yeah. In that particular case, though, I mean, they're taken into captivity. And, you know, they're being cared for. It's not like they've got to go and set up shop somewhere. But it's like being POW, essentially. So they would have been surely given jobs and provided food and not probably the best food, but clothing on the back and so forth. But still, they were people who lost their homes. And in this particular case, it was severe.
You know, someone came back and got their homes.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah, but after 70 years, some spiders and some other stuff in there probably by that time. We don't know if Priscilla and Aquila experienced any consequences. Based on what we've looked at, though, they surely suffered to some degree. And they were not only affected by the decree, they did abide by it. The end of verse 3 tells us that their trade was what? They were tent makers, so they moved from Italy, that would have been the center of the Roman Empire, to Corinth. The word translated depart, I think if you know that word is elsewhere translated divorce, that helps stress the point. Someone says, I got a divorce. Well, it's not, we're just not getting along. I mean, there has been this cutting off, this separation. And that's the word that is used to describe the departure there for the expelling. All right. The Bible does not tell us when Aquila and Priscilla became Christians. If you were to look at 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 19, you would see that Priscilla is altered there as far as the spelling. She was called also Prissa, P-R-I-S-C-A. And as Don asked earlier, people are curious about that, but we simply don't know. They could have been among the Corinthian converts that we read about in Acts chapter 18 and verse 8. That's possible. I'm not sure that that is the most likely view. It's also possible, and I think more likely, that they were Christians before they and Paul met. Now somebody says, well, why, if they were Christians, why didn't Luke state their spiritual status? Why not just say there were two Christians, they'd been kicked out of Rome, they come here and Paul meets up with them and they were able to start a house church, something like that. He could have done that. I do think, though, that Paul and the work here at Corinth, that's the focus, and that's sort of where Luke wants to take things. And describing Aquila and Priscilla as Jews, that's more consistent with this is how they got there, this is why they got there, and less focus perhaps on why they were or were not Christians prior to this time. All right, we've got, as you look at Priscilla and Aquila, this is not the only time that we find them mentioned in Scripture. And as you look at the places where they are mentioned, you find that three times, once by Paul, twice by Luke, Priscilla's name is mentioned first. That happens sometimes when you look at married people. You can just kind of pick out the couple, and sometimes you hear the wife's name first, but I think more often in the conversations that I hear, the husband's name is mentioned first. We'll take a quick survey. Who thinks that in most of the conversations you hear, the husband's name is mentioned first? Raise your hand. All right, who thinks the wife's name is mentioned first? All right, well, we're in the minority there as far as the wife, and that was what I thought, and that's what you see with this couple. The question then becomes why? Why typically does it seem that the husband, the male, is mentioned first instead of the wife? Well, let's just start in general. Then we'll look at this couple in general. Gary will take you second, unless Marcia doesn't want to.
Well, I was just going to say, when we have two sons and one daughter, and when we talk about them and their spouses, we mention our children first.
Okay.
Although sometimes,
Okay, it could be relationship based that the female is mentioned first. That's a good answer, Gary. Okay. All right. So obviously family connections. Anything else? Don?
Well, traditionally, the wife takes the name of the husband, last name. So if you mention it, even somebody with the address, it's always not a next name Gibson. Mm-hmm. So, but it could be the other way.
Yeah, but why? Why sometimes the other way? There's still another answer or two that's out there that needs to be nailed. Julie?
One is more outgoing than the other.
Yeah, that's the other big answer. It is the woman who is the one who's always talking. It's the woman who is the one who's inviting people over. It's the woman who wants to jump into the conversation and offer an opinion. And the man is sitting back there being real quiet. You know, he is the major introvert while the wife is the major extrovert. And she's met everybody three times, and he's barely getting around to the second person before service has stopped. Now, nothing wrong with that, as long as he's a leader in the home. It is possible for women, though, to be a lot more outgoing, and if a female has that particular quality, and I can name some couples where that is true, oftentimes you will hear when someone refers to that couple, let's go to so-and-so's house, and when they say that, it's the woman that's mentioned first. Perhaps because, in this particular case, she was the one that initiated the idea. In this particular case, though, there are different views. Could Priscilla have been more active in her faith? I don't think that's a good explanation, but could she have been the more active Christian? Sure. And if that were true in a congregation today, would you suspect that a lot of people would mention the woman first? I would say that that would be possible, if not likely. Could it be that she had a higher social standing? Now, in our culture, that doesn't matter too much. But let's say, let's use an illustration here. Dolly Parton. I would say that at least the appearance of her is a major extrovert. I mean, she's out there on stage. Hi, how are you? Good to see you. Thousands of people in front of her. What about her husband, though?
You don't even know his
name.
Yeah, I don't even know his name. Now, and she talks about him sometimes. You know, he's content to be over there sort of in the dark. But if you were going, if you knew her and you were going to say, let's go to the Parton house tonight, who do you think would probably pop up as far as the first name? I'm sure that for most people, they would say Dolly. And you say, well, why mention her first? Well, we don't know the husband's name. That probably wouldn't be true. But still, in that particular illustration, we understand just because she has that personality, she would be the one that would stand out for. So a similar thing could be true for social status. What if there were a female senator and her husband had no political affiliation? I mean, he's the homemaker. Once again, I think you might say the woman's first. the woman's name is first, just because of where she stands in society. A more forceful personality, we touched on that earlier, or it could be that she excelled in Christian hospitality, or sometimes just Christian courtesy. Those are some of the reasons. Anything that you want to touch base on before we look at verses 3 and 4 of Acts 18? Ray.
You think of the Clintons.
Yes.
You hear Bill Clinton's name as much as we hear his wife's name.
Right. And when he was president, that focus was on him. Bill Clinton. But then after Hillary ran and he'd been out of office for a while, everything is Hillary. She really, and that would be a great example as far as a political reference. Let's go to see Hillary and Bill tonight. I'm sure that's how a lot of people refer to that. And we're not surprised by that, just because right now, in the past few years, there's been a ton of spotlight on her, whereas before, the spotlight had been on him. Very good. And sometimes, I think that's a good illustration to show that sometimes the things can be flipped around. The focus might be on the husband for a long time, and then it turns to the wife, or it might be on the wife, and then it reverts to the husband. Very good illustration. Thank you. That it? Okay, let's see what we've got in that third and fourth verse. And because he was of the same trade, that's Paul, he abode with them, and they wrought for, by the trade, they were tent makers. And he reasoned in the synagogue every Sabbath and persuaded Jews and Greeks. If Priscilla and Aquila became Christians before Paul comes to Corinth and meets them, verse 3 tells us that he was not staying with them. Let me restate that. Verse 3 tells us about why he was staying with them, because he was of the same trade, not because that they were Christians necessarily, but they engaged in the same kind of work. You think they would have been sympathetic, Christian or not? Here's Paul, comes by himself to Corinth, new guy in the block, doesn't know anything, and if he has any tools, probably not a ton of tools. You know, he needs some income. Nobody's supported him. So you see this guy, and he's willing to work. You're nice people, perhaps Christians. I think they were probably Christians. What would you do? All right, well, take him in, help him out somehow. We've got an extra room, and you can stay there for a little while. Paul did intend, as he was at Corinth, to support himself as far as trying to fund his own evangelistic efforts. You can see that in verse 4. He was reasoning in the synagogue. He did want to do the church work, but at the same time, he did need some income, so he picked up a secular job. In the book of 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 33, I believe, Paul said that if you get married, your attention is going to be divided or not. Anybody remember? It is going to be divided. I mean, you're going to have a spouse, and the spouse is going to obviously have some needs and want some things. So when it comes to church work, you're going to have some here, and you're going to have some over here. That appears to have been Paul's desire to have been able to solely focus on spiritual things, but that was not always true. As you look at Paul, he did face some difficulty because of this. Let's go over to 1 Corinthians for a second. He's working, trying to support himself. And then you've got some people who are somewhat critical. 1 Corinthians chapter 8, looking at verses 18 and 19, and then we'll also ask somebody to turn over to 2 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 7. But I'll read 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verses 18 and 19. He said, "What then is my reward? That when I preach the gospel, I may make my gospel without charge, so as not to use the full extent of my right." Again, it's going back to the time in Acts chapter 18. "For though I was free from all men, I brought myself under bondage to all, that I might gain the more." And then 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 7. All right, Julie?
I'm sorry, what is it?
2 Corinthians 11, 7.
"Did I commit sin in humbling myself that you might be exalted? Because I preach the gospel of God free of charge."
Okay, Paul said, "I humbled myself." Back in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, he uses words like enslavement. It appears that there were some people who were critical of Paul. He's preaching the gospel, at least for a time, on his own dime, making money so that he can do this for free. And there's some people who come along, unbelievably, and say, "Well, you know, that was kind of a humiliating thing. You were just trying to put yourself into a bad position for some reason." And Paul said, "No. This is something that needed done. This is something I wanted to do. I was willing to take that work, even though that was not my first choice. And you guys are just wrong about that." We don't know, as far as the information that we have, especially from Acts chapter 18, that Paul worked as a tent maker in Corinth. In fact, he may not have made a tent in his life. The word that Paul uses could describe leather making. I think for some people, they would say, well, that kind of gives me a new perspective on Paul. He could have made tents. That was a common thing in that day and time. Or there could have been leather that was involved with tents. But whatever his trade was, he did work with his hands somehow. He was a student of who? Anybody remember that rabbi by the name of Gamaliel? That's back in the book of Acts. Acts chapter 22 and verse 3. He may have been working at night. We kind of get a hint of that in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 9. He says...
Doesn't verse 3 say he practiced the same trade?
Yes. But when it says they were tent makers, what does that mean? If it means leather worker, then Paul was a leather worker. Priscilla and Aquila were also leather workers.
So in other words, they're leather workers, not making actual tents?
Like I say, there's some uncertainty. That would be the best word I think that I would put there. I don't know that I would stake my life on the fact that they were tent makers. Some do side on that and say they were tent makers. Some others say, we're leaning more towards the idea that the word means leather makers. Now, if you're working with leather, you obviously could still work with tents somehow. But if you're a tent maker, you may not necessarily work with leather. But when people say, I don't know that I would fuss over that if somebody wants to say, well, they were tent makers, okay. But I'm just saying the original word is sometimes understood to mean people who work with leather. And that's why I say he did work it with his hands. I'm not 100% sure that we can say it was exactly this or it was exactly that. You still in 2 Corinthians 11, Julie?
Yes.
Okay. In just a second, we're going to ask you to read 2 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 8. It's here that Paul made it clear he did not want to accept any money from the Corinthians. Then we'll give a reason for that.
I robbed other churches, taking away from them to minister to you.
Okay. Now, he comes to Corinth by himself, needs some help. Meets up with Priscilla and Aquila, whatever their trade is. They all do the same thing, and they're willing to, you know, take him in and work with him. Perhaps they're Christians at this period of time. And Paul says, I want to do this. I want to earn some money until some funding from congregations is coming. 2 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 8. And when that funding comes, how does he describe it? He says, I did what? I robbed. Well, do you think he put on his mask, so to speak, and went out and grabbed the money out of the collection plates? What's he mean, I robbed other churches? All right, he was out there actively seeking funds, and that's right. And his other friends helped that come to fruition. He's out there collecting funds, asking for funds, so that the Corinthians do not need to help him in any way. Well, there were a couple reasons for that. You had, back in this day and time, some itinerant preachers, you had some philosophers running around, and they were people who are just like today. I told Barb, I said, oh, you're going to feel better. I said, I just got my miracle spring water in the mail. Here it is. And I said, look, I said, they figured out now how you can fit that into an envelope that needs only one stamp. Before, they used to send you out a thick envelope, and there was a big package of his miraculous water. This is Peter Popoff, that crazy nut. But anyway... he figured out how to squish that down, and there really wasn't much in there, maybe like a teardrop full. But there were people like that in that day and time. And if you are of that persuasion, what are you trying to do? You're not really trying to heal people. You're trying to you're trying to make money for yourself. And he certainly wouldn't say it that way and perhaps doesn't see it that way, but that's what it boils down to. And you're going into a new community, and Corinth was a really ripe, rich field, but sin abounded there. And, you know, sometimes people say, it's just better to what? When it comes to doing something. Better not to do it, right? And Paul, as he looked at Corinth, that was his plan and that was his approach. It's better not to accept any support. Let's just go ahead and pick up the funding from somewhere else. And that finally did come. 2 Corinthians 11, you still there, Julie? Okay, let's drop down now and see what we've got in verse 9.
And when I was present with you and in need, I was a burden to no one, for what I lacked the brethren who came from Macedonia supplied, and in everything I kept myself from being burdensome to you, and so I will keep myself.
Okay, so here you start stringing those verses together, and here's the picture. Paul comes, he needs some help, he gets a little help from Aquila and Priscilla, perhaps through God's providence, starts working, is doing some preaching there in the synagogue, reasoning with the people and so forth. secular work, church work. Some time moves along. He gets some help from 2 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 9. His friends are able to bring that. He has robbed other churches, 2 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 8. And now what is he able to do finally? At Corinth, he's got a foundation financially to work from. Now what can he do? He can work without secular employment. He's able to preach the gospel with no hindrances. Today you find men in this country oftentimes that are able to do that, and that is certainly a good thing. You do find sometimes congregations where that's not possible, and you have a fellow who's working a job on the side. Maybe it's his primary income, and you just make do with the best circumstances that you have in those cases. Anything that you want to add or ask before I tie in something else? Okay. You think about Paul. He's there. He's providing. He's there to shop, or I guess some place of employment. Could that have helped him in terms of evangelism? Obviously, he's going to the synagogue on Saturday and reasoning there, but he's working that job. Could that have helped him?
Sure.
Could there be some cases where a guy is trying to preach, working a secular job, but there's no connection between that job and evangelistic work? What if you're a drywaller on the side? How many people are you going to meet each day? Probably not many. I mean, homeowner may not be home, or if it's new construction, you got some other workers there. It's just not very conducive. But if you are a tent maker, or perhaps you are a leather maker, what's probably going to happen? Yeah. It's like the guy, did anybody ever go to a shoe shop? Well, maybe that's not the best illustration. Anybody ever go to an appliance repair shop? A small shop. Anybody ever buy a TV? Anybody ever buy a TV from one of the old shops? You know, it was the guy in, oh yeah, a couple that are under 40 are shaking, I never had that experience. I was an admirer. So age is showing, I guess, on both sides of the coin today. But there are some shops where people go for little fix-it things, right? You know, you go in there to get your eyeglasses adjusted and the tech, you know, agree on that one. You go in there and the tech is talking, hi, how's your day? And, you know, that's nice. And, Sunday's coming. And you have a chance to talk to people. And that surely gave Paul some opportunities. As people are coming to have things perhaps fixed or asking questions, maybe they wanted a tent repaired and so forth, or getting quotes. So it was not perhaps ideal, but it certainly was a whole lot better than some other things. And then, too, you have this. When you go and you interact with that small town shopkeeper, do you come away with an impression? Do you come away with an impression of the shopkeeper? Almost every time. And your impression could be what? Well, it's good or bad. That's a general answer, but let's make it a little more specific. What are you thinking about your interaction with the shopkeeper? All right, he was friendly or not?
He was very
helpful. Helpful or not?
He knew his business.
All right, he knew his stuff. He was qualified to do the work, and he did an excellent job or not? What else?
I recommend him.
All right, he is the guy that I want to recommend to my friends or not? Oh, there's more. Come on. All right, he seemed concerned about the community. He knew some things. And maybe, you know, asked me if I'd been over here to look at the site. So he showed some interest in me. What else? What's the biggie?
Reasonably priced.
There you go. What happens if you go into the shoe store and it's a $10 repair bill and he charges a $45? What are you thinking? He might be friendly and he might be good. He might be the best in town, but if it was 10 and if it was 45, you're going to recommend to your friends?
No.
Not unless you are absolutely desperate. That's the only pair of shoes that's available. Yes. Now, what happens if Paul, and again, I think that this could be the hand of God. You have somebody come into the shop talking to Paul. He's friendly. He's helpful. He's kind. He knows his stuff. He's reasonable. Anybody ever go into a shop and they fix something for free? All right. That has happened. And, well, how much? It's no charge. Well, you know, you did a little something. Hey, not a problem. I mean, I just didn't have anything to do today or no customers. are coming in until after the noon hour and so forth. You make an impression and you think, boy, you know, huh. And maybe ask a question or two. You know, are you just that nice of a guy?
It's good PR.
It is. Well, I happen to be a Christian. Or are you a Jew by chance? You seem like a nice person. We're going to have a synagogue service on Saturday. I'm going to give the Bible study, and I'd like you to come. He could have had a lot of opportunities. And maybe as he is doing this work, he's sowing some seeds that weren't quite ready to germinate. And he plants that crop, maybe not anything that he can understand at that moment. Sometimes it works that way in our life. Things are happening over here that we really can't kind of understand why, what's happening. But the dots finally get connected, and all of a sudden now he's able to go into full-time preaching, and perhaps those converts that had the seeds sown in their life, those begin to form the Corinthian church. Gary?
Something that might work for your younger than 40 crowd, there's a one-man body shop on my route. There's also one-man mechanic shops. And, you know, they take you in, they show you the problem, they can show you what they could do. They
yeah.
say, I can fix it this way, I can fix it that way. You get to really interact with them, and they, you know, how much are you willing to pay? Should we just do a quick job, or should we do it full out? And you can work that. I mean, you spend a lot of time with them, and they get to know your character that way.
Yeah, the world understands this principle. It understands it really well. What is it? Safe Glass Auto. Anybody ever seen their commercials? I think that's the one where call us, put the keys on the dash. And we'll be clean, and we'll be quick, and we'll be convenient, and we'll be reasonably priced. It is check, 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 and check. I have a broken windshield. Those are going to be the people I call. Now, I don't know that I would necessarily call them, but I'm saying that they do understand the kinds of things, and I think that they have probably done very, very well with that as far as a business model. And that should be our model as a Christian, because we can plant those seeds. But you're right. There are small businesses around, and that is how they work, and it helps them. They get that reputation. People say, I want to share that information with my friend. I will send someone that I know over there. That it? I thought another hand started to flash. Okay, let's go back to the text and look at verse 4. That reminds us of how God's word should be used in every assembly. Notice again, any reason in the synagogue, how many Sabbaths?
Every
Sabbath. This is something that offered him another opportunity, and he wanted to do his best to persuade people concerning what the Bible says. And hopefully the people who come will have open hearts and minds, and they can be taught and persuaded. Here, Luke emphasizes what's taking place by using an imperfect tense verb, ongoing action. In verse 5, let's also get that in. We've got about 5 minutes left. But, there's a contrast. But when who arrived? Silas and Timothy. They come from where? They're back there in Macedonia. Paul was constrained by the word, testifying to the Jews that Jesus was the Christ. Paul, at different times in his life, did leave some people behind. We saw that back in Acts chapter 17, verses 14 and 15, and there were times where he was joined by additional helpers. That's also what we have here. Now, on this occasion, we've got Silas and Timothy. They're coming from Macedonia, and the ASV says that they were constrained, or he was constrained by the word. The King James says pressed in the spirit. That difference is due to a manuscript variation. We'll talk about that in just a second. But he is preaching, he's testifying to who? The Jews about what? Jesus being the Christ. What do you think the sermons would have been like? If you're talking to somebody about Jesus is the Christ, do you believe that Jesus is the Christ? A lot of people I think would say yes. But what happens if you ask a follow-up question? What does that mean? What does that mean to you? What does that mean to me? What does it mean? Is it just some idle fact? Well, Jesus is the Christ? Yep, I believe that. Or does that have meaning? Well, let's think about Christ. What's Christ mean? He is the Messiah. He is the anointed. He is the Savior of man. So if you believe that Jesus is the Messiah or the Christ or the Savior, how does that affect daily life? He is my Lord. He is my master. He's the one that I need to heed when it comes to his word and his will. You find that this verse, as far as Acts 18:5, it's another hint or another way of saying that Paul was able to finally terminate his secular work and resume his full-time ministry as a gospel preacher. Second Corinthians 11:9, going back to that passage that Julie read, Philippians 4:15, that we'll not read, would also be a good cross-reference. Now let's talk about the textual variant for just a second. ASV says constrained by the word. King James translation says pressed in spirit. The best idea as far as trying to convey the thought seems to be something like Paul started, he began to hold himself to the word. Now that seems like a strange expression, but it's another way of saying that Paul becomes wholly absorbed in preaching. Remember 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 33, we talked about the husband and wife. Your interest is going to be split. Have to have some over here, have to have some over here. That was no longer true for Paul. And once again, 2 Corinthians 11, 8 and 9 is a good cross-reference. It is not ideal to work a second job. I did that for a little less than a year and was able to try to hold things together. But the Bible does say the laborer is worthy of his hire. Luke chapter 10 and verse 9. And a similar passage is in Galatians chapter 6 and verse 6. Anything that you'd like to discuss or help us close out on? Well, let's at least look at Acts chapter 18 and verse 6. And when they opposed themselves and blasphemed, so he's able to preach, working with these Jews, they decided that they didn't want to listen. He shook out his raiment or clothing and said unto them, your blood be upon your own heads, I'm clean. From henceforth I will go to the Gentiles. Paul's able to sort of pick up steam here with the financial support that he's received. He's gotten this strong reaction, and now he says, I'm ready to shift things. The plan is for me to be out 2 weeks from today, drive down and meet up, or fly down and meet up with Teresa, and then we're going to vacation back together for 2 weeks. So I think we're going to shut things down here, and then 2 weeks from today, because we are about ready to deal with Ephesus and Paul's work there, I think I'm going to have a standalone class on Ephesus and maybe some things from Ephesians. We've seen a little bit from Corinth, and remember that when you look at Paul's life, two cities are, at least biblically speaking, the most important in Paul's life. One is Corinth that we're reading about here. The other is the one that we're about to read about or study about, and that is Ephesus.